off again with an aching howl of engines, and wrenching his flight through the air so violently as he wove his way through the filthy barrages of flak that the six planes were soon flung out all over the sky like prayers, each one a pushover for the German fighters, which was just fine with Yossarian, for there were no German fighters anymore, and he did not want any exploding planes near his when they exploded. Only when all the Sturm und Drang had been left far behind would he tip his flak helmet back wearily on his sweating head and stop barking directions to McWatt at the controls, who had nothing better to wonder about at a time like that than where the bombs had fallen. "Bombay clear," Sergeant Knight in the back would announce.
"Did we hit the bridge?" McWatt would ask.
"I couldn't see, sir. I kept getting bounced around back here and pretty hard, and I couldn't see. Everything's covered with smoke now, and I can't see."
"Hey, Arfie, did the bombs hit the target?"
"What target?" Captain Aardvark, Yossarian's plump, pipe-smoking navigator, would say from the confusion of maps he had created at Yossarian's side in the nose of the ship.
"I don't think we're at the target yet, are we?"
"Yossarian, did the bombs hit the target?"
"What bombs?" answered Yossarian, whose only concern had been the flak.
"Oh, well," McWatt would sing. "What the hell?"
Yossarian did not give a damn whether he hit the target or not, just as long as Havermeyer or one of the other lead bombardiers did, and they never had to go back. Every now and then, someone grew angry enough at Havermeyer to throw a punch at him.
"I said you men leave Captain Havermeyer alone,"
Captain Cathcart warned them all angrily.
"I said he's the best damned bombardier we've got, didn't I?"
Havermeyer grinned at the colonel's intervention and shoved another piece of peanut brittle inside his face. Havermeyer had grown very proficient at shooting field mice at night with the gun he had stolen from the dead man in Yossarian's tent. His bait was a bar of candy, and he would pre-sight in the darkness as he sat waiting for the nibble with a finger of his other hand inside a loop of the line he had run from the frame of his mosquito net to the chain of the unfrosted light bulb overhead. The line was taut as a banjo string, and the merest tug would snap it on and blind the shivering quarry in a blaze of light. Havermeyer would chortle exultantly as he watched the tiny mammal freeze and roll its terrified eyes about in frantic search of the intruder. Havermeyer would wait until the eyes fell upon his own, and then he laughed aloud and pulled the trigger at the same time, showering the rank, furry body all over the tent with a reverberating crash and dispatching its timid soul back to his or her creator. Late one night, Havermeyer fired a shot at a mouse that brought Hungry Joe bolting out at him barefoot, ranting at the top of his screechy voice, and emptying his own .45 into Havermeyer's tent as he came charging down one side of the ditch and up the other, and vanished all at once inside one of the slit trenches that had appeared like magic beside every tent the morning after Milo Minderbinder had bombed the squadron. It was just before dawn during the great big siege of Bologna, when tongueless dead men peopled the night hours like living ghosts, and Hungry Joe was half out of his mind with anxiety because he had finished his missions again and was not scheduled to fly. Hungry Joe was babbling incoherently when they fished him out from the dank bottom of the slit trench, babbling of snakes, rats, and spiders. The others flashed their searchlights down just to make sure. There was nothing inside but a few inches of stagnant rainwater.
"You see," cried Havermeyer, "I told you. I told you he was crazy, didn't I?"
4. Doc Danica. Hungry Joe was crazy, and no one knew it better than Yossarian, who did everything he could to help him. Hungry Joe just wouldn't listen to Yossarian. Hungry Joe just wouldn't listen because he thought Yossarian was crazy.
"Why should he listen to you?"
Doc Danica inquired of Yossarian without looking up.
"Because he's got troubles."
Doc Danica snorted scornfully.
"He thinks he's got troubles. What about me?"
Doc Danica continued slowly with a gloomy sneer.
"Oh, I'm not complaining. I know there's a war on. I know a lot of people are going to have to suffer for us to win it. But why must I be one of them? Why don't they draft some of these old doctors who keep shooting their kissers off in public about what big sacrifices the medical game stands ready to make? I don't want to make sacrifices. I want to make dough.
Doc Danica was a very neat, clean man whose idea of a good time was to sulk. He had a dark complexion and a small, wise, saturnine face with mournful pouches under both eyes. He brooded over his health continually and went almost daily to the medical tent to have his temperature taken by one of the two enlisted men there who ran things for him practically on their own, and ran it so efficiently that he was left with little else to do but sit in the sunlight with his stuffed nose and wonder what other people were so worried about. Their names were Gus and Wes, and they had succeeded in elevating medicine to an exact science. All men reporting on sick call with temperatures above 102 were rushed to the hospital. All those except Yossarian reporting on sick call with temperatures below 102 had their gums and toes painted with gentian violet solution and were given a laxative to throw away into the bushes. All those reporting on sick call with temperatures of exactly 102 were asked to return in an hour to have their temperatures taken again. Yossarian, with his temperature of 101, could go to the hospital whenever he wanted to, because he was not afraid of them. The system worked just fine for everybody, especially for Doc Danica, who found himself with all the time he needed to watch old Major de Coverley pitching horseshoes in his private horseshoe pitching pit, still wearing the transparent eye patch Dr. Danica had fashioned for him from the strip of celluloid stolen from Major Major's orderly room window months before, when Major de Coverley had returned from Rome with an injured cornea after renting two apartments there for the officers and enlisted men to use on their rest leaves. The only time Dr. Danica ever went to the medical tent was the time he began to feel he was a very sick man each day and stopped in just to have Gus and Wes look him over. They could never find anything wrong with him. His temperature was always 96.8, which was perfectly all right with them as long as he didn't mind. Dr. Danica did mind. He was beginning to lose confidence in Gus and Wes and was thinking of having them both transferred back to the motor pool and replaced by someone who could find something wrong. Dr. Danica was personally familiar with a number of things that were drastically wrong. In addition to his health, he worried about the Pacific Ocean and flight time. Health was something no one ever could be sure of for a long enough time. The Pacific Ocean was a body of water surrounded on all sides by elephantiasis and other dread diseases, to which, if he ever displeased Colonel Cathcart by grounding Yossarian, he might suddenly find himself transferred. And flight time was the time he had to spend in airplane flight each month in order to get his flight pay. Dr. Danica hated to fly. He felt imprisoned in an airplane. In an airplane, there was absolutely no place in the world to go except to another part of the airplane. Dr. Danica had been told that people who enjoyed climbing into an airplane were really giving vent to a subconscious desire to climb back into the womb. He had been told this by Yossarian, who made it possible for Dan Danica to collect his flight pay each month without ever climbing back into the womb. Yossarian would persuade McWatt to enter Dr. Danica's name on his flight log for training missions or trips to Rome. "You know how it is," Dr. Danica had wheedled with a sly conspiratorial wink. "Why take chances when I don't have to?"
"Sure," Yossarian agreed.
"What difference does it make to anyone, if I'm in the plane or not?"
"No difference."
"Sure, that's what I mean," Dr. Danica said. "A little grease is what makes this world go round. One hand washes the other, know what I mean? You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours."
Yossarian knew what he meant.
"That's not what I meant," Dr. Danica said as Yossarian began scratching his back. "I'm talking about cooperation, favors. You do a favor for me, I'll do one for you. Get it?"
"Do one for me," Yossarian requested.
"Not a chance," Dr. Danica answered.
There was something fearful and minute about Dr. Nika as he sat despondently outside his tent in the sunlight as often as he could, dressed in khaki summer trousers and a short-sleeved summer shirt that was bleached almost to an antiseptic gray by the daily laundering to which he had it subjected. He was like a man who had grown frozen with horror once and had never come completely unthawed. He sat all tucked up into himself, his slender shoulders huddled halfway around his head, his suntanned hands with their luminous silver fingernails massaging the backs of his bare folded arms gently, as though he were cold. Actually, he was a very warm, compassionate man who never stopped feeling sorry for himself.
"Why me?"
was his constant lament, and the question was a good one. Yossarian knew it was a good one, because Yossarian was a collector of good questions and had used them to disrupt the educational sessions Clevenger had once conducted two nights a week in Captain Black's intelligence tent with the corporal in eyeglasses who everybody knew was probably a subversive. Captain Black knew he was a subversive because he wore eyeglasses and used words like panacea and utopia, and because he disapproved of Adolf Hitler, who had done such a great job of combating un-American activities in Germany. Yossarian attended the education sessions because he wanted to find out why so many people were working so hard to kill him. A handful of other men were also interested, and the questions were many and good when Clevenger and the subversive corporal finished and made the mistake of asking if there were any.
Who is Spain?
Why is Hitler?
When is Wright? Where was that stooped and mealy-colored man I used to call Papa when the merry-go-round broke down? How was Trump at Munich? Ho, ho, berry, berry.
And balls!
All rang out in rapid succession, and then there was Yossarian with the question that had no answer.
Where are the Snowdens of yesteryear?
The question upset them, because Snowden had been killed over Avignon, when Dobbs went crazy in midair and seized the controls away from Hoopel. The corporal played it dumb.
What?
He asked.
Where are the Snowdens of yesteryear?
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Où sont les neiges d'antan?
Yossarian said to make it easier for him.
Parlez en anglais, for Christ's sake, said the corporal. Je ne parle pas français.
Neither do I, answered Yossarian, who was ready to pursue him through all the words in the world to wring the knowledge from him if he could. But Clevenger intervened. Pale, thin, and laboring for breath, a humid coating of tears already glistening in his undernourished eyes.
Group headquarters was alarmed, for there was no telling what people might find out once they felt free to ask whatever questions they wanted to. Colonel Cathcart sent Colonel Korn to stop it, and Colonel Korn succeeded with a rule governing the asking of questions. Colonel Korn's rule was a stroke of genius, Colonel Korn explained in his report to Colonel Cathcart. Under Colonel Korn's rule, the only people permitted to ask questions were those who never did. Soon, the only people attending were those who never asked questions, and the sessions were discontinued altogether, since Clevenger, the corporal, and Colonel Korn agreed that it was neither possible nor necessary to educate people who never questioned anything. Colonel Cathcart and Lieutenant Colonel Korn lived and worked in the group headquarters building, as did all the members of the headquarters staff, with the exception of the chaplain. The group headquarters building was an enormous, windy, antiquated structure built of powdery red stone and banging plumbing. Behind the building was the modern skeet shooting range that had been constructed by Colonel Cathcart for the exclusive recreation of the officers at Group, and at which every officer and enlisted man on combat status now, thanks to General Dreidel, had to spend a minimum of 8 hours a month. Yossarian shot skeet, but never hit any. Appleby shot skeet and never missed. Yossarian was as bad at shooting skeet as he was at gambling. He could never win money gambling, either. Even when he cheated, he couldn't win, because the people he cheated against were always better at cheating, too. These were two disappointments to which he had resigned himself. He would never be a skeet shooter, and he would never make money.
It takes brains not to make money,
Colonel Cargill wrote in one of the homiletic memoranda he regularly prepared for circulation over General Peckham's signature.
Any fool can make money these days, and most of them do. But what about people with talent and brains? Name, for example, one poet who makes money.
T.S. Eliot, ex-PFC Wintergreen said in his mail-sorting cubicle at 27th Air Force Headquarters and slammed down the telephone without identifying himself. Colonel Cargill in Rome was perplexed.
"Who was it?"
asked General Peckham.
"I don't know,"
Colonel Cargill replied.
"What did he want?"
"I don't know."
"Well, what did he say?"
"T.S. Eliot,"
Colonel Cargill informed him.
"What's that?"
"T.S. Eliot,"
Colonel Cargill repeated.
"Just T.S.?"
"Yes, sir. That's all he said. Just T.S. Eliot."
"I wonder what it means,"
General Peckham reflected. Colonel Cargill wondered, too.
"T.S. Eliot,"
General Peckham mused.
"T.S. Eliot,"
Colonel Cargill echoed with the same funereal puzzlement. General Peckham roused himself after a moment with an unctuous and benignant smile. His expression was shrewd and sophisticated. His eyes gleamed maliciously.
"Have someone get me General Dreidel," he requested Colonel Cargill.
"Don't let him know who's calling."
Colonel Cargill handed him the phone.
"T.S. Eliot,"
General Peckham said, and hung up.
"Who was it?"
asked Colonel Moodus. General Dreidel in Corsica did not reply. Colonel Moodus was General Dreidel's son-in-law, and General Dreidel, at the insistence of his wife and against his own better judgment, had taken him into the military business. General Dreidel gazed at Colonel Moodus with level hatred. He detested the very sight of his son-in-law, who was his aide and therefore in constant attendance upon him. He had opposed his daughter's marriage to Colonel Moodus because he disliked attending weddings. Wearing a menacing and preoccupied scowl, General Dreidel moved to the full-length mirror in his office and stared at his stocky reflection. He had a grizzled, broad-browed head with iron-gray tufts over his eyes and a blunt and belligerent jaw. He brooded in ponderous speculation over the cryptic message he had just received. Slowly his face softened with an idea, and he curled his lips with wicked pleasure.
"Get Peckham," he told Colonel Moodus. "Don't let the bastard know who's calling."
"Who was it?"
asked Colonel Cargill back in Rome.
"That same person,"
General Peckham replied with a definite trace of alarm.
"Now he's after me."
"What did he want?"
"I don't know."
"What did he say?"
"The same thing."
"T.S. Eliot?"
"Yes, T.S. Eliot. That's all he said."
General Peckham had a hopeful thought.
"Perhaps it's a new code or something, like the colors of the day. Why don't you have someone check with communications and see if it's a new code or something, or the colors of the day?"
Communications answered that T.S. Eliot was not a new code or the colors of the day. Colonel Cargill had the next idea.
"Maybe I ought to phone 27th Air Force Headquarters and see if they know anything about it. They have a clerk up there named Wintergreen I'm pretty close to. He's the one who tipped me off that our prose was too prolix."
Ex-PFC Wintergreen told Colonel Cargill that there was no record at 27th Air Force Headquarters of a T.S. Eliot.
"How's our prose these days?"
Colonel Cargill decided to inquire while he had ex-PFC Wintergreen on the phone.
"It's much better now, isn't it?"
"It's still too prolix,"
ex-PFC Wintergreen replied.
"It wouldn't surprise me if General Dreidel were behind the whole thing,"
General Peckham confessed at last.
"Remember what he did to that skeet shooting range?"
General Dreidel had thrown open Colonel Cathcart's private skeet shooting range to every officer and enlisted man in the group on combat duty. General Dreidel wanted his men to spend as much time out on the skeet shooting range as the facilities in their flight schedule would allow. Shooting skeet 8 hours a month was excellent training for them. It trained them to shoot skeet.
Thank you.
Dunbar loved shooting skeet because he hated every minute of it, and the time passed so slowly. He had figured out that a single hour on the skeet shooting range with people like Havermeyer and Appleby could be worth as much as 11 times 17 years.
"I think you're crazy,"
was the way Clevenger had responded to Dunbar's discovery. "Who wants to know?" Dunbar answered.
"I mean it,"
Clevenger insisted.
"Who cares?"
Dunbar answered.
"I really do. I'll even go so far as to concede that life seems longer. It is longer. It is long. Is longer? All right. Is longer if it's filled with periods of boredom and discomfort. But
guess how fast?" Dunbar said suddenly.
"Huh?" "They go,"
Dunbar explained.
"Who?" "Years." "Years?" "Years," said Dunbar. "Years, years, years."
"Clevenger, why don't you let Dunbar alone?" Yossarian broke in. "Don't you realize the toll this is taking?"
"It's all right," said Dunbar magnanimously. "I have some decades to spare. Do you know how long a year takes when it's going away?"
"And you shut up also,"
Yossarian told Orr, who had begun to snigger.
I was just thinking about that girl," Orr said. "That girl in Sicily, that girl in Sicily with a bald head."
"You'd better shut up also," Yossarian warned him.
"It's your fault," Dunbar said to Yossarian. "Why don't you let him snigger if he wants to? It's better than having him talking."
"All right, go ahead and snigger if you want to."
"Do you know how long a year takes when it's going away?"
Dunbar repeated to Clevenger.
"This long." He snapped his fingers.
"A second ago, you were stepping into college with your lungs full of fresh air. Today, you're an old man."
"Old?" asked Clevenger with surprise. "What are you talking about?"
"Old."
"I'm not old."
"You're inches away from death every time you go on a mission. How much older can you be at your age? A half minute before that, you were stepping into high school, and an unhooked brassiere was as close as you ever hoped to get to paradise. Only a fifth of a second before that, you were a small kid with a 10-week summer vacation that lasted 100,000 years and still ended too soon. Zip! They go rocketing by so fast. How the hell else are you ever going to slow time down?"
Dunbar was almost angry when he finished.
"Well, maybe it is true,"
Clevenger conceded unwillingly in a subdued tone.
"Maybe a long life does have to be filled with many unpleasant conditions if it's to seem long. But in that event, who wants one?"
"I do,"
Dunbar told him.
"Why?"
Clevenger asked.
"What else is there?"
5. Chief White Half-Oat. Doc Danica lived in a splotched gray tent with Chief White Half-Oat, whom he feared and despised.
"I can just picture his liver," Doc Danica grumbled. "Picture my liver,"
Yossarian advised him.
"There's nothing wrong with your liver." "That shows how much you don't know,"
Yossarian bluffed, and told Doc Danica about the troublesome pain in his liver that had troubled Nurse Duckett and Nurse Kramer and all the doctors in the hospital because it wouldn't become jaundice and wouldn't go away. Doc Danica wasn't interested.
"You think you've got troubles?" he wanted to know. "What about me? You should have been in my office the day those newlyweds walked in."
"What newlyweds?"
"Those newlyweds that walked into my office one day. Didn't I ever tell you about them? She was lovely."
So was Doc Danica's office. He had decorated his waiting room with goldfish and one of the finest suites of cheap furniture. Whatever he could, he bought on credit, even the goldfish. For the rest, he obtained money from greedy relatives in exchange for shares of the profits. His office was in Staten Island, in a 2-family fire trap just 4 blocks away from the ferry stop, and only 1 block south of a supermarket, 3 beauty parlors, and 2 corrupt druggists. It was a corner location, but nothing helped. Population turnover was small, and people clung through habit to the same physicians they had been doing business with for years. Bills piled up rapidly. and he was soon faced with the loss of his most precious medical instruments. His adding machine was repossessed, and then his typewriter. The goldfish died. Fortunately, just when things were blackest, the war broke out.
"It was a godsend,"
Dr. Nika confessed solemnly.
"Most of the other doctors were soon in the service, and things picked up overnight. The corner location really started paying off, and I soon found myself handling more patients than I could handle competently. I upped my kickback fee with those two drug stores. The beauty parlors were good for 2-3 abortions a week. Things couldn't have been better, and then look what happened. They had to send a guy from the draft board around to look me over. I was 4E. I had examined myself pretty thoroughly and discovered that I was unfit for military service. You'd think my word would be enough, wouldn't you, since I was a doctor in good standing with my county medical society and with my local Better Business Bureau? But no, it wasn't. And they sent this guy around just to make sure I really did have one leg amputated at the hip and was helplessly bedridden with incurable rheumatoid arthritis. Yossarian, we live in an age of distrust and deteriorating spiritual values. It's a terrible thing.
Dr. Nika protested in a voice quavering with strong emotion.
It's a terrible thing when even the word of a licensed physician is suspected by the country he loves.
Dr. Nika had been drafted and shipped to Pianosa as a flight surgeon, even though he was terrified of flying.
"I don't have to go looking for trouble in an airplane," he noted, blinking his beady brown, offended eyes myopically. "It comes looking for me, like that virgin I'm telling you about that couldn't have a baby."
"What virgin?" Yossarian asked. "I thought you were telling me about some newlyweds."
"That's the virgin I'm telling you about. They were just a couple of young kids, and they'd been married, a little over a year, when they came walking into my office without an appointment. You should have seen her. She was so sweet and young and pretty. She even blushed when I asked about her periods. I don't think I'll ever stop loving that girl. She was built like a dream and wore a chain around her neck with a medal of St. Anthony hanging down inside the most beautiful bosom I never saw. It must be a terrible temptation for St. Anthony, I joked, just to put her at ease, you know. St. Anthony? Her husband said. Who's St. Anthony? Ask your wife, I told him. She can tell you who St. Anthony is. Who is St. Anthony? He asked her. Who? She wanted to know. "St. Anthony," he told her. "St. Anthony," she said. "Who's St. Anthony?" When I got a good look at her inside my examination room, I found she was still a virgin. I spoke to her husband alone while she was putting her girdle back on and hooking it onto her stockings. "Every night," he boasted, a real wise guy, you know. "I never miss a night," he boasted. He meant it, too. "I even been putting it to her mornings before the breakfast she makes me before we go to work," he boasted. There was only one explanation. When I had them both together again, I gave them a demonstration of intercourse with the rubber models I've got in my office. I've got these rubber models in my office with all the reproductive organs of both sexes that I keep locked up in separate cabinets to avoid a scandal. I mean, I used to have them. I don't have anything anymore. Not even a practice. The only thing I have now is this low temperature that I'm really starting to worry about. Those two kids I've got working for me in the medical tent aren't worth a damn as diagnosticians. All they know how to do is complain. They think they've got troubles. What about me? They should have been in my office that day with those two newlyweds looking at me as though I were telling them something nobody'd ever heard before. You never saw anybody so interested. "You mean like this?" he asked me and worked the models for himself a while. You know, I can see where a certain type of person might get a big kick out of doing just that. "That's it," I told him. "Now you go home and try it my way for a few months and see what happens, okay?" "Okay," they said, and paid me in cash without any argument. "Have a good time," I told him, and they thanked me and walked out together. He had his arm around her waist as though he couldn't wait to get her home and put it to her again. A few days later, he came back all by himself and told my nurse he had to see me right away. As soon as we were alone, he punched me in the nose.
He did what?
He called me a wise guy and punched me in the nose. "What are you, a wise guy?" he said, and knocked me flat on my ass. Pow! Just like that. I'm not kidding.
"I know you're not kidding," Yossarian said, "but why did he do it?"
"How should I know why he did it?" Dr. Nika retorted with annoyance. "Maybe it had something to do with St. Anthony?"
Dr. Nika looked at Yossarian blankly.
"St. Anthony?" he asked with astonishment. "Who's St. Anthony?"
"How should I know?"
answered Chief White Half-Hoat, staggering inside the tent just then with a bottle of whiskey cradled in his arm and sitting himself down pugnaciously between the two of them. Dr. Nika rose without a word and moved his chair outside the tent, his back bowed by the compact kit of injustices that was his perpetual burden. He could not bear the company of his roommate. Chief White Half-Hoat thought he was crazy.
"I don't know what's the matter with that guy," he observed reproachfully. "He's got no brains. That's what's the matter with him. If he had any brains, he'd grab a shovel and start digging. Right here in the tent, he'd start digging, right under my cot. He'd strike oil in no time. Don't he know how that enlisted man struck oil with a shovel back in the States? Didn't he ever hear what happened to that kid? What was the name of that rotten rat bastard pimp of a snot-nose back in Colorado? Wintergreen? Wintergreen."
"He's afraid," Yossarian explained.
"Oh, no, not Wintergreen." Chief White Half-Hoat shook his head with undisguised admiration. "That stinking little punk wise guy son of a bitch ain't afraid of nobody."
"Dr. Nika's afraid. That's what's the matter with him."
"What's he afraid of?"
"He's afraid of you," Yossarian said. "He's afraid you're going to die of pneumonia."
"He'd better be afraid," Chief White Half-Hoat said. A deep, low laugh tumbled through his massive chest. "I will, too. The first chance I get, you just wait and see."
Chief White Half-Hoat was a handsome, swarthy Indian from Oklahoma, with a heavy, hard-boned face and tousled black hair, a half-blooded Creek from Enid who, for occult reasons of his own, had made up his mind to die of pneumonia. He was a glowering, vengeful, disillusioned Indian who hated foreigners with names like Cathcart, Corn, Black, and Havermeyer, and wished they'd all go back to where their lousy ancestors had come from.
"You wouldn't believe it, Yossarian," he ruminated,
raising his voice deliberately to bait Dr. Nika.
"But this used to be a pretty good country to live in before they loused it up with their goddamn piety."
Chief White Half-Hoat was out to revenge himself upon the white man. He could barely read or write and had been assigned to Captain Black as assistant intelligence officer.
"How could I learn to read or write?"
Chief White Half-Hoat demanded with simulated belligerence, raising his voice again so that Dr. Nika would hear.
"Every place we pitched our tent, they sank an oil well. Every time they sank a well, they hit oil. And every time they hit oil, they made us pack up our tent and go someplace else. We're human divining rods. Our whole family had a natural affinity for petroleum deposits. And soon every oil company in the world had technicians chasing us around. We're always on the move. It was one hell of a way to bring a child up, I can tell you. I don't think I ever spent more than a week in one place."
His earliest memory was of a geologist.
"Every time another white half-oat was born," he continued, "the stock market turned bullish. Soon whole drilling crews were following us around with all their equipment just to get the jump on each other. Companies began to merge just so they could cut down on the number of people they had to assign to us. But the crowd in back of us kept growing. We never got a good night's sleep. When we stopped, they stopped. When we moved, They move. Chuck wagons, bulldozers, derricks, generators. We're a walking business boom. And we began to receive invitations from some of the best hotels just for the amount of business we would drag into town with us. Some of those invitations were mighty generous, but we couldn't accept any because we were Indians, and all the best hotels that were inviting us wouldn't accept Indians as guests. Racial prejudice is a terrible thing, Yosarin. It really is. It's a terrible thing to treat a decent, loyal Indian like a nigger, kike, whopper, spick. Chief White Half-Oat nodded slowly with conviction. Then, Yosarin, it finally happened. The beginning of the end. They began to follow us around from in front. They would try to guess where we were going to stop next and would begin drilling before we even got there, so we couldn't even stop. As soon as we began to unroll our blankets, they would kick us off. They had confidence in us. They wouldn't even wait to strike oil before they kicked us off. We were so tired, we almost didn't care the day our time ran out. One morning, we found ourselves completely surrounded by oil men waiting for us to come their way so they could kick us off. Everywhere you looked, there was an oil man on a ridge, waiting there like Indians getting ready to attack. It was the end. We couldn't stay where we were because we had just been kicked off, and there was no place left for us to go. Only the army saved me. Luckily, the war broke out just in the nick of time, and a draft board picked me right up out of the middle and put me down safely in Lowry Field, Colorado. I was the only survivor.
Yosarin knew he was lying but did not interrupt, as Chief White Half-Oat went on to claim that he had never heard from his parents again. That didn't bother him too much, though, for he had only their word for it that they were his parents, and since they had lied to him about so many other things, they could just as well have been lying to him about that, too. He was much better acquainted with the fate of a tribe of first cousins who had wandered away north in a diversionary movement and pushed inadvertently into Canada. When they tried to return, they were stopped at the border by American immigration authorities who would not let them back into the country. They could not come back in because they were red. It was a horrible joke, but Dr. Nika didn't laugh until Yosarin came to him one mission later and pleaded again without any real expectation of success to be grounded. Dr. Nika snickered once and was soon immersed in problems of his own, which included Chief White Half-Oat, who had been challenging him all that morning to Indian wrestle, and Yosarin, who decided right then and there to go crazy.
"You're wasting your time," Dr. Nika was forced to tell him.
"Can't you ground someone who's crazy?"
"Oh, sure, I have to. There's a rule saying I have to ground anyone who's crazy."
"Then why don't you ground me? I'm crazy. Ask Clevenger."
"Clevenger? Where is Clevenger? You find Clevenger and I'll ask him."
"Then ask any of the others. They'll tell you how crazy I am."
"They're crazy."
"Then why don't you ground them?"
"Why don't they ask me to ground them?"
"Because they're crazy. That's why."
"Of course they're crazy," Dr. Nika replied. "I just told you they're crazy, didn't I? And you can't let crazy people decide whether you're crazy or not, can you?"
Yosarin looked at him soberly and tried another approach.
"Is Orr crazy?"
"He sure is," Dr. Nika said.
"Can you ground him?"
"I sure can, but first he has to ask me to. That's part of the rule."
"Then why doesn't he ask you to?"
"Because he's crazy," Dr. Nika said. "He has to be crazy to keep flying combat missions after all the close calls he's had. Sure, I can ground Orr, but first he has to ask me to."
"That's all he has to do to be grounded?"
"That's all. Let him ask me."
"And then you can ground him?" Yosarin asked.
"No, then I can't ground him."
"You mean there's a catch?"
"Sure there's a catch," Dr. Nika replied. "Catch 22. Anyone who wants to get out of combat duty isn't really crazy."
There was only one catch, and that was catch 22, which specified that a concern for one's own safety in the face of dangers that were real and immediate was the process of a rational mind. Orr was crazy, and could be grounded. All he had to do was ask, and as soon as he did, he would no longer be crazy and would have to fly more missions. Or would be crazy to fly more missions and sane if he didn't, but if he was sane, he had to fly them. If he flew them, he was crazy and didn't have to. But if he didn't want to, he was sane and had to. Yossarian was moved very deeply by the absolute simplicity of this clause of Catch-22 and let out a respectful whistle.
"That's some catch, that Catch-22," he observed.
"It's the best there is," Dr. Nika agreed.
Yossarian saw it clearly in all its spinning reasonableness. There was an elliptical precision about its perfect pairs of parts that was graceful and shocking, like good modern art. And at times Yossarian wasn't quite sure that he saw it all, just the way he was never quite sure about good modern art or about the flies Orr saw in Appleby's eyes. He had Orr's word to take for the flies in Appleby's eyes.
"Oh, they're there all right,"
Orr had assured him about the flies in Appleby's eyes after Yossarian's fist fight with Appleby in the officers' club.
"Although he probably doesn't even know it. That's why he can't see things as they really are."
"How come he doesn't know it?" inquired Yossarian.
"Because he's got flies in his eyes," Orr explained with exaggerated patience. "How can he see he's got flies in his eyes if he's got flies in his eyes?"
It made as much sense as anything else, and Yossarian was willing to give Orr the benefit of the doubt because Orr was from the wilderness outside New York City and knew so much more about wildlife than Yossarian did, and because Orr, unlike Yossarian's mother, father, sister, brother, aunt, uncle, in-law, teacher, spiritual leader, legislator, neighbor, and newspaper, had never lied to him about anything crucial before. Yossarian had mulled his newfound knowledge about Appleby over in private for a day or two and then decided, as a good deed, to pass the word along to Appleby himself.
"Appleby, you've got flies in your eyes," he whispered helpfully as they passed by each other in the doorway of the parachute tent on the day of the weekly milk run to Parma.
"What?" Appleby responded sharply, thrown into confusion by the fact that Yossarian had spoken to him at all.
"You've got flies in your eyes," Yossarian repeated. "That's probably why you can't see them."
Appleby retreated from Yossarian with a look of loathing bewilderment and sulked in silence until he was in the jeep with Havermeyer riding down the long, straight road to the briefing room, where Major Danby, the fidgeting group operations officer, was waiting to conduct the preliminary briefing with all the lead pilots, bombardiers, and navigators. Appleby spoke in a soft voice so that he would not be heard by the driver or by Captain Black, who was stretched out with his eyes closed in the front seat of the jeep.
"Havermeyer," he asked hesitantly, "have I got flies in my eyes?"
Havermeyer blinked quizzically.
"Styes?" he asked.
"No, flies," he was told.
Havermeyer blinked again.
"Flies?"
"In my eyes."
"You must be crazy," Havermeyer said.
"No, I'm not crazy. Yossarian's crazy. Just tell me if I've got flies in my eyes or not. Go ahead, I can take it."
Havermeyer popped another piece of peanut brittle into his mouth and peered very closely into Appleby's eyes.
"I don't see any," he announced.
Appleby heaved an immense sigh of relief. Havermeyer had tiny bits of peanut brittle adhering to his lips, chin, and cheeks.
"You got peanut brittle crumbs on your face," Appleby remarked to him. "I'd rather have peanut brittle crumbs on my face than flies in my eyes," Havermeyer retorted.
The officers of the other five planes in each flight arrived in trucks for the general briefing that took place 30 minutes later. The three enlisted men in each crew were not briefed at all, but were carried directly out on the airfield to the separate planes in which they were scheduled to fly that day, where they waited around with the ground crew until the officers with whom they had been scheduled to fly swung off the rattling tailgates of the trucks delivering them, and it was time to climb aboard and start up. Engines rolled over disgruntledly on lollipop-shaped hardstands, resisting first, then idling smoothly a while, and then the planes lumbered around and nosed forward lamely over the pebbled ground like sightless, stupid, crippled things until they taxied into the line at the foot of the landing strip and took off swiftly, one behind the other, in a zooming, rising roar, banking slowly into formation over mottled treetops and circling the field at even speed until all the flights of six had been formed, and then setting course over cerulean water on the first leg of the journey to the target in northern Italy or France. The planes gained altitude steadily and were above 9,000 feet by the time they crossed into enemy territory. One of the surprising things always was the sense of calm and utter silence, broken only by the test rounds fired from the machine guns, by an occasional toneless, terse remark over the intercom, and, at last, by the sobering pronouncement of the bombardier in each plane that they were at the IP and about to turn toward the target. There was always sunshine, always a tiny sticking in the throat from the rarefied air. The B-25s they flew in were stable, dependable, dull green ships with twin rudders and engines and wide wings. Their single fault from where Yossarian sat as a bombardier was the tight crawlway separating the bombardier's compartment in the plexiglass nose from the nearest escape hatch. The crawlway was a narrow, square, cold tunnel hollowed out beneath the flight controls, and a large man like Yossarian could squeeze through only with difficulty. A chubby, moon-faced navigator with little reptilian eyes and a pipe like Arfi's had trouble, too, and Yossarian used to chase him back from the nose as they turned toward the target, now minutes away. There was a time of tension then, a time of waiting with nothing to hear and nothing to see and nothing to do but wait as the anti-aircraft guns below took aim and made ready to knock them all sprawling into infinite sleep if they could. The crawlway was Yossarian's lifeline to outside from a plane about to fall. But Yossarian swore at it with seething antagonism, reviled it as an obstacle put there by Providence as part of the plot that would destroy him. There was room for an additional escape hatch right there on the nose of a B-25, but there was no escape hatch. Instead, there was the crawlway, and since the mess on the mission over Avignon, he had learned to detest every mammoth inch of it, for it slung him seconds and seconds away from his parachute, which was too bulky to be taken up front with him, and seconds more after that away from the escape hatch on the floor between the rear of the elevated flight deck and the feet of the faceless top turret gunner mounted high above. Yossarian longed to be where Arfi could be once Yossarian had chased him back from the nose. Yossarian longed to sit on the floor in a huddled ball right on top of the escape hatch, inside a sheltering igloo of extra flak suits that he would have been happy to carry along with him, his parachute already hooked to his harness where it belonged, one fist clenching the red-handled ripcord, one fist gripping the emergency hatch release that would spill him earthward into air at the first dreadful squeal of destruction. That was where he wanted to be, if he had to be there at all. Instead of hung out there in front like some goddamn cantilevered goldfish in some goddamn cantilevered goldfish bowl while the goddamn foul black tears of flak were bursting and booming and billowing all around and above and below him in a climbing, cracking, staggered, banging, phantasmagorical, cosmological wickedness that jarred and tossed and shivered, clattered and pierced, and threatened to annihilate them all in one splinter of a second, in one vast flash of fire. Arfi had been no use to Yossarian as a navigator, or as anything else, and Yossarian drove him back from the nose vehemently each time so that they would not clutter up each other's way if they had to scramble suddenly for safety. Once Yossarian had driven him back from the nose, Arfi was free to cower on the floor where Yossarian longed to cower, but he stood bolt upright instead, with his stumpy arms resting comfortably on the backs of the pilots and co-pilot seats, pipe in hand, making affable small talk to McWatt and whoever happened to be co-pilot, and pointing out amusing trivia in the sky to the two men, who were too busy to be interested. McQuat was too busy responding at the controls to Yossarian's strident instructions as Yossarian slipped the plane in on the bomb run and then whipped them all away violently around the ravenous pillars of exploding shells with curt, shrill, obscene commands to McQuat that were much like the anguished, entreating nightmare yelpings of Hungry Joe in the dark. Arfi would puff reflectively on his pipe throughout the whole chaotic clash, gazing with unruffled curiosity at the war through McWatt's window as though it were a remote disturbance that could not affect him. Arfi was a dedicated fraternity man who loved cheerleading and class reunions and did not have brains enough to be afraid. Yossarian did have brains enough, and was. And the only thing that stopped him from abandoning his post under fire and scurrying back through the crawlway like a yellow-bellied rat was his unwillingness to entrust the evasive action out of the target area to anybody else. There was nobody else in the world he would honor with so great a responsibility. There was nobody else he knew who was as big a coward. Yossarian was the best man in the group at evasive action, but had no idea why. There was no established procedure for evasive action. All you needed was fear, and Yossarian had plenty of that. More fear than Orr or Hungry Joe, more fear than even Dunbar, who had resigned himself submissively to the idea that he must die someday. Yossarian had not resigned himself to that idea, and he bolted for his life wildly on each mission the instant his bombs were away, hollering, "Hard! Hard! Hard! Hard, you bastard! Hard!" at McWatt, and hating McWatt viciously all the time, as though McWatt were to blame for their being up there at all to be rubbed out by strangers. And everybody else in the plane kept off the intercom, except for the pitiful time of the mess on the mission to Avignon, when Dobbs went crazy in midair and began weeping pathetically for help.
"Help him! Help him!" Dobbs sobbed. "Help him! Help him!"
"Help who? Help who?" called back Yossarian once he had plugged his headset back into the intercom system, after it had been jerked out when Dobbs wrested the controls away from Hoople and hurled them all down suddenly into the deafening, paralyzing, horrifying dive which had plastered Yossarian helplessly to the ceiling of the plane by the top of his head, and from which Hoople had rescued them just in time by seizing the controls back from Dobbs and leveling the ship out almost as suddenly, right back in the middle of the buffeting layer of the cacophonous flak from which they had escaped successfully only a moment before.
"Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God!" Yossarian had been pleading wordlessly as he dangled from the ceiling of the nose of the ship by the top of his head, unable to move. "The bombardier! The bombardier!"
Dobbs answered in a cry when Yossarian spoke.
"He doesn't answer! He doesn't answer! Help the bombardier! Help the bombardier!"
"I'm the bombardier!" Yossarian cried back at him. "I'm the bombardier. I'm all right. I'm all right."
"Then help him. Help him," Dobbs begged. "Help him. Help him."
And Snowden lay dying in back. 6. Hungry Joe. Hungry Joe did have 50 missions, but they were no help. He had his bags packed and was waiting again to go home. At night he had eerie, ear-splitting nightmares that kept everyone in the squadron awake but Hoople, the 15-year-old pilot who had lied about his age to get into the army and lived with his pet cat in the same tent with Hungry Joe. Hoople was a light sleeper but claimed he never heard Hungry Joe scream. Hungry Joe was sick.
"So what?" Dr. Nika snarled resentfully. "I had it made, I tell you. 50 grand a year I was knocking down, and almost all of it tax-free, since I made my customers pay me in cash. I had the strongest trade association in the world backing me up. And look what happened. Just when I was all set to really start stashing it away, they had to manufacture fascism and start a war horrible enough to affect even me. I gotta laugh when I hear someone like Hungry Joe screaming his brains out every night. I really gotta laugh. He's sick. How do you think I feel?"
Hungry Joe was too firmly embedded in calamities of his own to care how Dr. Nika felt. There were the noises, for instance. Small ones enraged him,
and he hollered himself hoarse at Arfi for the wet sucking sounds he made puffing on his pipe, at Orr for tinkering, at McWatt for the explosive snap he gave each card he turned over when he dealt at blackjack or poker, at Dobbs for letting his teeth chatter as he went blundering clumsily about bumping into things. Hungry Joe was a throbbing, ragged mess of motile irritability. The steady ticking of a watch in a quiet room crashed like torture against his unshielded brain.
"Listen, kid," he explained harshly to Hoople very late one evening, "if you want to live in this tent, you got to do like I do. You got to roll your wristwatch up in a pair of wool socks every night and keep it on the bottom of your footlocker on the other side of the room."
Hoople thrust his jaw out defiantly to let Hungry Joe know he couldn't be pushed around, and then did exactly as he had been told. Hungry Joe was a jumpy, emaciated wretch with a fleshless face of dingy skin and bone and twitching veins squirming subcutaneously in the blackened hollows behind his eyes like severed sections of snake. It was a desolate, cratered face, sooty with care like an abandoned mining town. Hungry Joe ate voraciously, gnawed incessantly at the tips of his fingers, stammered, choked, itched, sweated, salivated, and sprang from spot to spot fanatically with an intricate black camera with which he was always trying to take pictures of naked girls. They never came out. He was always forgetting to put film in the camera or turn on lights or remove the cover from the lens opening. It wasn't easy persuading naked girls to pose, but Hungry Joe had the knack.
"Me big man," he would shout. "Me big photographer from Life magazine. Big picture on heat, big cover. See, see, see. Hollywood star, multi-dinero, multi-divorces, multi-ficky-fick all day long."
Few women anywhere could resist such wily cajolery, and prostitutes would spring to their feet eagerly and hurl themselves into whatever fantastic poses he requested of them. Women killed Hungry Joe. His response to them as sexual beings was one of frenzied worship and idolatry. They were lovely, satisfying, maddening manifestations of the miraculous, instruments of pleasure too powerful to be measured, too keen to be endured, and too exquisite to be intended for employment by base, unworthy man. He can interpret their naked presence in his hands only as a cosmic oversight destined to be rectified speedily, and he was driven always to make what carnal use of them he could in the fleeting moment or two he felt he had before someone caught wise and whisked them away. He could never decide whether to furgle them or photograph them, for he had found it impossible to do both simultaneously. In fact, he was finding it almost impossible to do either, so scrambled were his powers of performance by the compulsive need for haste that invariably possessed him. The pictures never came out, and Hungry Joe never got in. The odd thing was that in civilian life, Hungry Joe really had been a photographer for Life magazine. He was a hero now, the biggest hero the Air Force had, Yossarian felt, for he had flown more combat tours of duty than any other hero the Air Force had. He had flown 6 combat tours of duty. Hungry Joe had finished flying his first combat tour of duty when 25 missions were all that were necessary for him to pack his bags, write happy letters home, and begin hounding Sergeant Towser humorously for the arrival of the orders rotating him back to the States. While he waited, he spent each day shuffling rhythmically around the entrance of the operations tent, making boisterous wisecracks to everybody who came by, and jocosely calling Sergeant Towser a lousy son of a bitch every time Sergeant Towser popped out of the orderly room. Hungry Joe had finished flying his first 25 missions during the week of the Salerno beachhead, when Yossarian was laid up in the hospital with a burst of clap he had caught on a low-level mission over a whack in bushes on a supply flight to Marrakesh. Yossarian did his best to catch up with Hungry Joe, and almost did, flying 6 missions in 6 days, but his 23rd mission was to Arezzo, where Colonel Nevers was killed, and that was as close as he had ever been able to come to going home. The next day, Colonel Cathcart was there, brimming with tough pride in his new outfit, and celebrating his assumption of command by raising the number of missions required from 25 to 30. Hungry Joe unpacked his bags and rewrote the happy letters home. He stopped hounding Sergeant Towser humorously. He began hating Sergeant Towser, focusing all blame upon him venomously, even though he knew Sergeant Towser had nothing to do with the arrival of Colonel Cathcart or the delay in the processing of shipping orders that might have rescued him 7 days earlier and 5 times since. Hungry Joe could no longer stand the strain.